There is no one size fits all. That's the other thing about this. You know, you have to have it in line with your business direction, your size, your maturity, all of those sorts of things. Very often people ask me for, you know, blueprints or, you know, what does good look like? And my answer is always the same. It varies depending on your stage of maturity and your willingness to spend and how important your data is to you.
You're listening to the ISF podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, in light of a number of damaging hacks that have recently been made public, Nick Witchell interviews Steve about the threat landscape. They consider the challenges regulators face given the current geopolitical situation and discuss how organizations can create a thorough cyber defense and response plan.
Steve, as ever, challenging times, uncertain times, a period of political flux in many countries at the moment. Let's start, if we may, with criminal activity, the activity of cyber gangs, attacks on critical national infrastructure here in the UK, clearly also happening around the world. I mean, there are two parts to this, aren't there? There is the response of the organisations or the companies, and there is the advice, whether it's good advice, that they are receiving from the authorities. Now, from the contact that you have, you meet a lot of companies, information technology specialists. Are they sufficiently aware of the dangers, and are they doing enough about it? I mean, again, it's a terrible generalisation, but in broad terms, what's your assessment of the state of readiness, as it were?
I think we've still got a way to go. If I'm being honest about it, I don't think they are doing enough. And I think that if you look at the vendor community, it's all about what product can we ship rather than what are you trying to do to protect the organisation. And I think that organisations like the ISF, like some of the other associations that are out there, probably could do more to make more of a noise about what you should be doing.
Okay, come back to that in a moment. I mean, so is it the case that too many organisations, too many companies are simply just crossing their fingers and hoping that it won't happen to us? They read about it happening to Synovus, this NHS contractor here in the United Kingdom, a 40 million ransomware demand. And they're hoping, goodness me, you know, let's just stay quiet and hope that nobody comes after us.
I think there is some of that. I think the other thing that is out there is that, of course, a lot of organisations have outsourced to a third party. And so they feel as if they've abdicated responsibility. And you haven't. You haven't abdicated that responsibility. You can't abdicate responsibility. You are responsible for the collection of data, the maintenance of the integrity of that data, irrespective of who happens to be holding it. And I think we should be doing very much more from an authority standpoint to actually hold companies accountable to that. I mean, we had things like GDPR, but I do think that we've been a little bit slow in the UK to actually hold board members, chief executives, to account when their organisations patently fall short.
When you say we, who do you mean? Do you mean the shareholders, the ISF? I mean,
I think it is shareholders. I think there is also a role for government, legislators, the ICO. I think that, you know, the economic climate obviously is very fragile. And so maybe that is holding things back a little, I don't know. But we have to move away from this, you know, shrug your shoulders, it happens, to really holding people accountable for, did they make the right decision? You know, did they assess the risk appropriately? Did they do all that was possible and reasonable to prevent something happening? Breaches, attacks will always happen. But have you got a strong incident response plan? Have you done the utmost to assess the security capability of your third parties? You know, are you doing that on an ongoing basis? And that's where I think we need to be spending more time.
And that, I imagine, is an area where the ISF can render particular assistance in terms of advice.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have done to a certain extent, you know, over the past 18 months, we've done very much more in the whole area of incident response, preparedness for security breach. We've recently updated our standard of good practice, which is the policy framework that really maps across to all sorts of standards that organisations are using. So from an ISF member perspective, I think we're doing quite a bit in that space. But, you know, I can't control how an organisation then takes on board that information. I can just make it available to them.
So it's up to the information security officers. More pertinently, it's up to more senior board members to appreciate the need to take action on this. It's the same discussion we've been having for years, isn't it? That chief executives don't necessarily grip this or grasp this.
I think that's right. And I look to myself, because obviously I run an organisation as well as providing all of this information to our members. We are a self-contained entity in our own right, so we have to also worry about security and how we're protecting information. And I'm constantly challenged as to how much money are we going to spend on that component as opposed to providing service to our members. And it is always going to be a trade-off. But I think that you have to keep it constantly under review. You always have to look at it from the perspective of, you know, what is the worst that can happen? And if it were to happen, what would the response be? And that, I think, is something that all chief executives, all boards of directors need to be doing on a much more regular basis now.
Every major nation here in Europe, North America, around the world, has professionals, has a cyber security centre. Now, do you feel, and without making this too UK-centric, mm-hmm. because this is being looked at and listened to by people in many different nations, but are the cyber security centres doing what is necessary in terms of getting out and advising people, companies, effectively, do you think?
I think there's a lot of information available. I would say that there is probably too much information at the technical level. And what is interesting for me from a security standpoint is that, yes, of course, you need to understand some of those technical measures. You need to patch regularly. You need to keep your systems up to date and so on. But the bigger issues where we're seeing some of these breaches taking place are coming from the people elements. They're coming from a lack of awareness from business leaders, a lack of commitment from the top of companies to actually implement some of these things, because all of this comes at a cost, of course. And all too often, I think security is an easy target. If you're looking to save a little bit of money, well, let's slash that, because I can't see a direct link between what I'm spending on security and return on investment. And that is an area where both the business and security really need to get their heads together to figure it out. And the technical elements, yes, they have to happen. But to your point about, you know, whether or not national institutions are doing enough in the technical space, yes, I think they are. It's in that other area now that they need to be focusing.
But do they need to be not merely reactive, but more proactive and get out there and underline to senior executives the need to do as you've been describing?
Personally, I think they do. I mean, the argument that they will give you is that that's not their job. That's not what they're there to do. You know, you have a board of directors, you have shareholders, you have regulators. That's their role. They should be doing that. And I'm not one to... I don't love regulation. I don't love legislation. But I think there is a need for it in certain areas. And I think that in the UK in particular, we're relatively light touch in some of those spaces. And I think that probably means that we need to tighten things up a little bit. If you look at AI as an example, you've got the EU's AI Act, which is coming out fairly shortly. It's been approved, now needs to receive the approval of the different member states. The UK has gone for a slightly different approach, slightly less stringent. Is that the right thing? Is that the wrong thing? It's the decision that the government of the day has taken to try to encourage investment, I would say, into the UK. And so it's a balance that that government has made. Is that the right one to make? And who holds them accountable for that? And I don't think there has been enough focus on the security components of everything that we do at that level. It's certainly not a vote winner, you know.
Well, interesting that you mentioned that. It doesn't figure at all in the UK general election. One wouldn't expect it to. It's such a specialised niche area. But do you sense that this is on anybody's political agenda in anything like an appropriate fashion?
You know, it was interesting. I was having a conversation about AI with somebody the other day and talking about AI regulation. And they said, forget regulating AI. We need to be regulating technology. Because everybody now is so focused on the use of technology. It's all pervasive. If you take technology away from people, they're lost. And there are all sorts of research going on at the moment in terms of doing that and seeing what happens. If that is the case, if technology really is that fundamental to society, then yes, government needs to be doing something about it.
Just before we leave the sort of criminal element to all of this. Let me just ask you this. It's a period of particular tension with Russia. Do you think governments are in any way inhibited from making a fuss about what is happening within Russia, the cyber gangs? You know, there's no doubt about where many of these attacks are coming from.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they don't want to ratchet up the already quite worryingly high degree of tension that there is between Russia and the West.
The fact that there are a number of cyber gangs that are headquartered, for want of a better word, in Russia, isn't new. We've always had that challenge. I think that we've tried in the West to overcome some of that through negotiation. That's the problem we've got now. You know, it is very difficult to enter into those kinds of negotiations because everything is so focused on the things that are going on in the
Ukraine. Yeah, and a few years ago, I can remember, I think, conversations where there was some hope that the Russian authorities might cooperate to root out the cyber criminal gangs within the Russian territory. I mean, there is absolutely no hope now, is there?
No, and I think the same applies to other parts of the world as well. You know, if we look at China, for instance, and some other parts. So we have to find a way of working around that.
And is it the case, do you sense, that the problem is actually much, much bigger than anybody is publicly admitting to?
Well, certainly we always have to bear in mind that when we talk about cyber gangs, you know, these are very sophisticated, very well-trained, very well-funded organizations now. They do have access to state-of-the-art tools. They are using AI, for instance. And we haven't seen yet any very significant, I would say, AI-driven attacks. My concern is that we will at some point. And so we always have to focus on what are we going to do to defend against that first. But perhaps more importantly, we have to be turning our attention to how do we ensure the resilience of our organizations, because we will be attacked. So how are we going to get back up and running, protect the information that is absolutely central to our businesses?
So is it purely about defense and resilience, or can you foresee a situation in which Western governments would feel that there is a need to be more aggressive in our response to what is coming at our companies and organizations from within these territories that you've identified?
I don't think we're at that point yet. I think we're probably still viewing things a little bit too traditionally. Now, of course, there will be people listening to this who will say, well, he doesn't know what we're actually doing because we're not telling anybody what's going on. You know, I like others, will just measure it on the amount of attacks that we see and judge the effectiveness on that basis.
It's interesting, I think, that you use the expression, they're not telling us what's going on. And I think there is a big element of that, isn't there, in this area?
There is
a lot going on that we're not aware of, that no governments are actually admitting to or pushing out there into the public domain. I mean, I see you nodding. I mean, that's clearly your impression as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be perfectly honest, Nick, I would hope that that were the case. Because I think that's what's necessary, and you don't necessarily want to go shouting from the rooftops as to what it is that you're doing in that area.
So the responsibility on individual organisations and companies, on the ISF, is to ensure that that defence, that resilience, is in the best form, best shape that it possibly can be.
Absolutely. And that is why we spend a tremendous amount of time, you know, with our members, looking at how they can best implement some of those resilient measures that are appropriate for them, because there is no one size fits all. That's the other thing about this. You know, you have to have it in line with your business direction, your size, your maturity, all of those sorts of things. Very often people ask me for, you know, blueprints or, you know, what does good look like? And my answer is always the same. It varies depending on your stage of maturity and your willingness to spend and how important your data is to you.
You've described the ISF's role, which is to offer advice, good advice and an analysis. Do you think that the ISF should perhaps be more out in the public domain itself and actually campaigning more openly and more publicly and more determinedly on these issues?
I think that we have always taken the position that we will not be a lobbying organisation. And I think that is fair. I really don't want to get into that. But you raise a very interesting point. The world today, from a security standpoint, is very different from the world 35 plus years ago when the ISF was established. And I do think that there is a role for us today to be more vocal, more public about what we believe organizations should be doing, what we believe regulators might want to do or governments should be doing, without overstepping. So we don't want to be one of those organisations that's constantly barracking people and complaining. We want to be holding true to some of our founding principles, which is about providing best advice, providing some of the best tools, providing some of the best insights that we gather from our own team and also from our member community. But we do need to make more noise about that, because people desperately need to understand some of the implications and, indeed, very much more importantly, what they can actually practically do about it.
And the legislators, the parliamentarians, you know, the prime ministers and the ministers need to be, if not held to account, then they need to have this message underlined to them, perhaps in ways that aren't currently happening. Do you feel that that is correct?
I do. And, you know, very few parliamentarians, ministers come from a security background. They just don't. In the UK in particular, we have a very large number of professional politicians. And so I think that providing some of that insight, some of that guidance, is something that everybody would benefit from, frankly.
I talked at the start about uncertainties, and criminal activity is one cause of that, and these cyber attacks and so on. But you've talked about the proliferation of new technologies, the introduction, which is quite scary to many people, of AI and its proliferation. I mean, what effect do you feel this is having on society as a whole?
I think, you know, I go back to what I was saying about AI and technology. I think technology, and I'm probably, you know, some people probably think I'm sounding like a complete Luddite here, but technology has somewhat taken over. And we always need to keep at the back of our minds that with the best will in the world, technology will let you down at some point. And so it may not have a significant impact, but you cannot be 100% reliant upon it. And I think we see too much focus on technology and not enough focus on us as people and our use of technology. So if you look at smart motorways, as an example in the UK, the smart motorway was supposed to be, you know, completely foolproof. Technology was going to answer all of the queries and it was going to be completely safe. Well, we know for a fact it isn't. We know for a fact that technology was never going to be 100% effective. But did we plan for that? I would say no. Others may disagree. But again, it's instances like that where we have to plan for the fact that technology is not going to be 100% right, effective, every single time. And I fear that we're training or teaching our children to be over-reliant on it and losing some of those basic skills that will be required come the day when the smartphone fails and they've no idea how to get from A to B.
The direction of travel is unstoppable, and clearly you wouldn't wish to stop it.
No.
I think what you're saying is, of course, it must evolve and we must advance, but we need to keep in mind that this is not foolproof, that we must have backup systems and we must not lose the ability as people to be versatile and to always keep in mind that there may need to be another way of doing things.
Absolutely, and if you look at some of the biggest breaches that have taken place, technology has not got those companies back up and running. People have done it. People have had to intervene. And we cannot afford to lose that.
And do you feel that companies, again, I'm sorry, it's a very broad, sweeping, general question, but that companies, big companies that you deal with, are sufficiently aware of this aspect of the direction that they should be inculcating?
I think, sadly, it comes down to a question of investment. And the companies that I would say are best placed to deal with that have really come at it from a risk management perspective. They have balanced up the business direction that they are headed in with the cost of making sure that their systems are able to support that, and I include security in that. Others haven't done so. And I think this is where some of the challenge comes in from a security standpoint with third parties, you know, and all of the issues around supply chain management and so on. Because a company's ecosystem now isn't just within these four walls. You know, it's global. There are so many different layers to it. And the challenge for organizations is really trying to understand what is most appropriate for them in terms of managing risk across all of those multiple layers. And that is not a trivial task. And so, you know, we're not talking about quick fixes to some of this. We're talking about really well thought through, well-funded approaches to security within the organization, within the ecosystem. But I absolutely believe, passionately believe, that that will provide competitive differentiation. And we haven't had that from a security standpoint. We haven't been able to say that about security up until fairly recently, because it was all about just doing the basics. Now it's very much more than that. And I think that is the big shift that we need to see.
So it requires a much more sophisticated outlook, doesn't it, by senior directors, managers, executives, that after years when we thought that technology could solve so many things, and indeed it has, you're saying that, well, hang on a minute, that approach has inherent risks to it, because there is a danger that you lose sight of the necessary component of keeping people in the equation and the ability of people to be versatile and to solve problems.
No, absolutely.
Well, fascinating as ever. Steve, as you look out there, what is the one thing that worries you the most at the moment?
I think the one thing that probably worries me most is this is going to sound harsh. It's an almost sort of blasé approach that I see that organizations are taking to the implementation of technology as a means to drive their business forward without regard to the what happens when it goes wrong question, as we've just been talking about. I really am very bothered about that. Because as we've seen with some of the fairly major breaches that have taken place, I mean, let's go back to the ransomware attack on the hospitals. You know, that has very real impact on people's lives. That has had a tremendous effect on waiting lists, on operations. And so that sort of blending of technology now, you know, into the real world, if you want to call it that, where it starts to have an impact on you and I and people that we know, we haven't probably seen that as much as we're starting to now. And so from a business standpoint, from a leadership standpoint, we need to be taking that into account. Whether or not we're doing that effectively or efficiently, whether we're funding it appropriately, I don't know. And so that's what worries me.
Many things for leaders to ponder. Steve Durbin, as ever, more questions, more answers perhaps at the Congress in Orlando.
Indeed.
But for the moment, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Nick.
Our thanks to Nick Witchell for contributing to today's episode. We'll be back with a new episode next week. In the meantime, if you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast, and we'd be pleased if you'd consider sharing the episode. To become a member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. Don't miss our other podcast, Dear InfoSec, sharing conversations with members about the real-world applications of ISF research. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.